This is The Conversation. It's episode 140 with Emma Hanley, gallerist, young gallerist at the Jack Hanley Gallery in New York on the Lower East Side. It's her father's gallery. We'll talk about how she got there. And she, before that, was at Christie's and graduated, I believe, in 2012, Emma. Is that correct? Born in 1990. So this is the first guest that I've had born in 1990 or later. Yeah, that's pretty young. But she acquits herself beautifully, very thoughtful and gracious guest. I'm Michael Shaw. I was born in 1890. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images of Emma with her father at NADA, with her colleague at NADA, at various other art events around New York. And you can find past episodes. I want to bring you up to speed on a couple of recent ones. The last episode, 139, was with Amanda Yates Garcia, a Los Angeles-based witch and artist. You will find out what it entails being a witch in the 21st century. Let's just say as a little preview that it's a combination of healer, shaman, and life coach rolled up into one. That was a rare live recording done in Los Angeles with co-host Deb Cloudman. Prior to that, 138 was with Ben Davis, author of 9.5 Theses on Art and Class and ArtNet News national critic. And that was quite a provocative and thought-provoking episode, as I expected it would be. A lot of you have reached out and mentioned how affecting it was, and I'm glad to hear that. And if you have felt the same way, I'd be happy to hear from you as well. And yeah, I don't know if we're going to have a part two. That's very unlikely based on his schedule, but I'm happy to have had him. And I am always on the hunt for sort of art-adjacent potential guests, and I would very much like to crowdsource you guys right now. I have tried recently to get a hold of a couple of sort of style-slash-economy journalists at the New York Times to talk to about subjects that are sort of art-adjacent. One of them is a reporter named Nelson Schwartz, who covers the economy, did a recent piece on a money-based caste system sort of developing in companies and who they reach out to. I thought it would be very interesting to talk to him about his piece and related things that he has found out. I reached out to him via Twitter, did not hear back. And I also reached out to Brooks Barnes, who has a column in the style section. That's not to say it's only about style. It's more the scene. And he recently did a piece on, I believe, Stephen Tisch is his name, the LA-based collector, and his private collection, which he built a museum for on his former tennis court in Benedict Canyon. And I wanted to talk to him not only about that, Brooks Barnes, but things related and what he covers. I reached out to him via email, did not hear back. If you have all that to say, that if you have any connections that you can hook me up with related to these sort of art-adjacent type things, I would very much appreciate it. Shoot me an email through the website. All right. Thank you so much. I will talk to you more on the back end, so stay tuned for that. In the meantime, let's get into that conversation with Emma Hanley. Thank you very much for being here, and I will talk to you on the back end.
I thought we would kind of review. It's funny, I usually ask people in New York, okay, so where are you? And I was so curious when I spoke to you before that I wanted to ask you then. I don't know what it was that you said, but I'm just going to review for people listening that you are in the West Village. And
yes, I am.
And I will review as well that you have been in New York for 4 years when you moved after graduating from Berkeley, correct?
Precisely, yes.
Okay, good. And I think we might get into what it's like living in the West Village, but I feel like it might be better to get into that later. So what did you major in at Berkeley?
I did art history, which I guess I knew after my high school was quite a, I guess it's a college preparatory high school, you could say. I mean, it's literally called University High School.
In New York, where is that?
Oh, sorry. It's in San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
and they have a really great course that you take, I think, as a sophomore called Western Civilization. And it's sort of a rite of passage for anyone going to the high school. And you take the history of music, history of art, and European history all together, sort of, you know, chronologically for a year. And from that, I was exposed to art history, and I have quite a good memory as sort of just, like, I remember things in images. So, like, if you ask me what someone was wearing on a certain day, if I was remembering it, I'll remember, like, the full, like, there was a tree on your right, you were wearing a denim shirt, you know, whatever it was.
So is that a is that a version of photographic memory?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I don't venture that I have a photographic memory since it's, like, so incredibly rare. But I know that, like, it's a weird, like, I was great at memory games, for instance. It really bothered everyone in my family because we would play, and it was, like, an unfair advantage, basically.
Right.
But it meant that, like, art history, and I mean, my parents are both artists, so perhaps that's just the way I was able to see the world was essentially through images. But it meant that I was really not as good at history as music. Like, I didn't really take, you know, learn to play a musical instrument growing up. So understanding parts of an orchestra didn't come naturally to me. So that was hard, but it was so well balanced. I know.
I'm you know why I'm laughing, right? Because, yeah, that must have been awful that you were so musically, you know, orchestra organizationally disinclined. That must have been devastating.
It's never going to come up at any point in my life, probably in the future.
Yeah.
But it was, like, really hard in this one class. And I think because of that, I turned to, like, oh, great. Well, I can balance out my grade by, like, I have an image in my head of what this painting looks like. I'll just go through, like, you know, in clockwise formation and, like, explain what I remember seeing.
Right.
So that was, like, a handicap. And, I mean, I'm very minorly dyslexic, so I always, growing up, I mixed up, you know, B's for D's or numbers. So I got really good at remembering a picture of it so that I couldn't mess it up, if that makes sense.
Yeah. You know,
I'm pretty good at spelling.
I was thinking, as you're talking about the visual strength of your memory, that I have a really strong memory of faces. You know, when I see somebody you know, and I can't necessarily place them, but I'm like, I know I have seen that person. And so the thing that I was thinking in addition to that is, and this kind of applies to you as well, although it's probably a little more obvious, is what function does that actually serve? Sometimes I feel like it's better to not recognize people so that you're not, you know, so that the balance is more even, you know, that you both are meeting each other again and you hadn't remembered each other, as opposed to, oh, I remember exactly who you are, and then the other person doesn't have any idea. Yeah.
No, it's like your mind reading. It's, unfortunately, you're spot on in that I have a great memory for faces. In fact, it's probably how I got the job at Christie's. Was I said, I have, unfortunately, it's been quoted back to me by who was my business manager, that I had an uncanny ability to recognize faces, which I didn't really think through the word choice when I wrote in my cover letter.
Uh-huh.
But I definitely do, and I'm only laughing because Adrian Brody just was at Freeze, and I was at a cafe, a Dimes Cafe in the Lower East Side, right before I was heading to NADA one day. And I, like, went right up to him and was like, hey, nice to see you. And thankfully, he's with Michael Stipe, who, you know, is a friend of my dad's, and it all worked out just fine that I could play it off like, oh, yeah, we've all met before. But I only knew him because, like, I've seen a penis, and, like, I don't know, I've read a magazine in the past year. And so it totally happens where I'm like, oh, I know you. We're good friends, obviously. And then it's like, oh, no, you're famous. I don't actually know you.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, I actually, that remind my, excuse me, this is kind of an embarrassing anecdote in a way, but I was...
Oh, worse than mine?
Well, it's different, but it's similar. I was in Soho, and back when there were galleries in Soho, and I was in a gallery, and this person walked in as I had sort of was about to finish the show, and I was like, wow, that person looks really familiar. Where do I know them from? And it was John McEnroe. And I remember,
oh,
I remember turning, you know, like getting really embarrassed just because I was, you know, I had this feeling that I knew this person, but in fact, you know, it was just somebody famous.
That's pretty great. Well, I mean, I guess unless he's like swearing and throwing a racket, you know.
Well, he's always on the edge of doing that in one way or another. But that's another story.
Yeah.
So tell me about Christie's. Was this during college or after college?
Well, I interned at Sotheby's when I was in college. But no, I happened to just apply. And there was a woman I worked in the Impressionist and Modern department. There's a woman who's going on maternity leave. So they just sort of needed another person to help out. And so I guess my timing was quite serendipitous. And yeah, I got the job. Let's see. I remember my start date was July 7th. And I graduated. This is embarrassing, but I told human resources I was graduating in June because I wanted to, like, you know, have some time after graduation, like travel or hang out with friends or what have you. And so they're like, okay, great. Like, we'll push it back. You can start in July. No worries. I was like, cool. I get even more time than I was expecting. And so I remember I was like on a boat in Turkey with my friend's family. And I get this call, like, okay, Emma, like, we're so excited that you're starting in 2 weeks. We have the mandatory drug screening, and we've scheduled your, you know, screening for tomorrow. I hope you can, like, you know, take it nearby in Berkeley. And I had to have this, like, really sketchy, like, Skype phone call that kept breaking up, being like, hey, I know it's, like, you know, whatever, 7 p.m. your time on a Friday. You probably want to leave the office, but, like, can we reschedule my drug test? You know what I said? I was graduating. Like, not true. I really just wanted to travel or, like, hang out. And because of that, I also now need to look, like, really shady and reschedule it for 2 weeks from now.
Right.
I managed to still get the job, so I guess it wasn't such an issue. But I remember, like, just thinking, oh, my God, they're probably going to think I'm some, like, crazy drug addict or what have you.
Right. That's funny. So you worked at both Sotheby's and Christie's for a time?
I did, yep.
What were the lengths of each of those tenures that you had?
Let's see. I did the sort of Sotheby's summer internship. Mm. I think I was like 20 or 21 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And then I worked at Christie's right after I graduated from college up until last year.
Okay. I guess the bigger question, I think, or the subtextual question maybe that's going on, you know, in charting through your training or education in art is whether it was kind of inevitable either at the time or in retrospect that you were going to go into follow your father into contemporary art gallery work, or if there was a point where you were going to maybe get into the auction world or something like that and you changed course at some point?
Well, I mean, I guess in however convoluted a sense this seems, I was applying to colleges and I got into RISD and I got into Berkeley. And at RISD, I would do art, and at Berkeley, I was thinking I'd do art history. And it seemed too similar to my parents both being artists to do art. And I liked that, you know, art was kind of pragmatic. Like you're staring at a blank canvas and you're finding a solution or you're working through something or what have you. And I liked that, but I also really like learning and history. And I think art history married the two. So in that way, I was somewhat breaking away from, like, nobody in my family actually studied art history that I'm aware of. Maybe a, you know, course here and there, but for being entrenched in the art world, it's kind of it seemed different enough. But then I didn't really have any sort of mindset of that I was going to go work at my father's gallery. I mean, he's had a gallery for 29 years, and I don't know. I guess it's silly to think that I wouldn't be interested in that, but it wasn't until I was at this new museum opening, and I was getting a drink with my dad at the bar and talking to Jerry Saltz, and he was like, hey, this is so ridiculous that you don't work at your dad's gallery. He's got a phenomenal eye. Like, why in the world do you work in the arts and not with him? And I mean, maybe my dad had considered prior to this, my working for him or what have you. I hadn't, that's for sure. And I was like, wow, that's kind of crazy. Like, that's a good idea. He's like, yeah, you totally should come work for me. And then that was kind of the beginning of the end. And I don't know, I had no plan of leaving Christie's. I really enjoyed it. I learned a ton. It's like a really phenomenal experience and education that I'm so thankful for, but it seemed like such a waste to have a father that had a gallery and not ever try out working with him.
It's
and
really,
what that meant.
It's funny that, so Jerry Saltz, matchmaker between father and daughter.
I know. It's hilarious. And, yeah, Roberta's come in the gallery a couple of times and been like, reminded him of that fact that like,
right.
Emma's here because of you.
So one of the things that really sticks out from that anecdote is, so Jerry Saltz thinks you, this very young woman in the art community, or in the auction community, if you will, has this great eye. How would he have any idea what kind of eye you have?
I mean, I can flatter myself that maybe it just is, you know, oozing out of me, but I think more likely, my dad taught at UT, from what I understand, when my dad taught at UT, often, and my dad and my mom went there, I think that's when Jerry and Roberta were both living in Austin. And so I think he spent a lot of time, or they know each other quite well, as well as like, you know, Peter and Sally Saul. And I think it's probably from sort of knowing my dad, he assumes that I would have that talent. I don't know.
Huh.
I'm also somewhat comfortable talking to all sorts of people. I think that's sort of a trait I get probably from my mom's side. So there's a lot of women on my mom's family. And I don't know, they all seem very confident.
Interesting.
The
other thing that we'll come back to your mom in a second, because you mentioned that both your parents are artists, and I don't know to what extent your dad still makes work having had a gallery for almost 30 years, but without necessarily getting into that for the moment, just generally, I would think that a child with two artist parents would be so many reasons to be discouraged from becoming an artist, unless they were, you know, Claus Oldenburg and his wife, or, you know, what have you, somebody like that.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, my siblings don't do anything in the art world, so I guess there's the opposite side of the coin there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's hard. I mean, you see, if you're a doctor, it makes sense that your kid would want to be a doctor. It's like a very relatable profession. There's like a quantity that you are putting out in the world that's tangible. And I mean, not commodifiable per se, but like you have a trade that you can move anywhere in the world, and being a doctor is like a wonderful gift to the world. And I think of art that way as well. But I think for a lot of people, it's not a job that you'll, you know, make money, that you'll be recognized. It's not like an easy road. So I get not jumping at that.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. I mean, you know, I don't know, maybe being around the artists that many of them, it sounds like from the early days, particularly extremely successful, colors your sense of what it's like to be an artist in a very different way than if you are just the child of, you know, regular struggling artists or something like that.
Yeah, and I mean, I think in a lot of ways, like my father opened the gallery because he needed a space. You know, he liked encouraging his friends that painted and, you know, buying their work and so forth. But I don't think it was a natural transition. Now I know there's a bunch of artist-run galleries, but I mean, a gallery is a business. So
yeah,
to go from being an artist where you're sort of working from, like, well, if you're lucky, solo show to solo show, but essentially exhibition to exhibition, it's not like a steady paycheck. So it's not your finance. It's not the same. At least I don't see it as the same. So for him, I mean, he always jokes he wishes he had taken, you know, a couple more business classes or what have you. But
right. But it turns out he didn't need to, apparently.
Yeah. And I mean, I think if art advising had existed when he started in, I guess, 87, he would have been like the most successful art advisor I can imagine. He's got a phenomenal eye. And, you know, if he could be telling people, hey, buy this artist, I think they're super cool. I mean, any artist that he's been interested in has become a huge, huge international success. I mean, like, all the artists he showed when I was growing up are like the top 10 prices in the world. It's just, it's amazing.
Mm. Right. So yeah. So
which I guess,
now you have a fresh perspective on that, having sort of been away from it for a period, if only a brief period, before ultimately deciding through Jerry Saltz that you needed to get into it.
Yeah. I mean, and I think it was maybe inevitable in some like greater cosmic sense, but I certainly didn't predict like I'm gonna go take over my dad's gallery and this is what's happening. Not at all.
Right. You know, it's funny, when we first were getting in touch and you have this area code phone number for San Francisco, I was thinking, you know, I wasn't clear on the gallery having, you know, long since left San Francisco and being in New York. And then in looking into the dates and whatnot, it occurred to me that you, even though you went to Berkeley, you basically missed the San Francisco run as far as your work. You know, all of your work has been in New York with the gallery. So, but I guess all that to say that when the gallery was in San Francisco, I mean, were you working there at all, you know, just even to help out, or were you just...
Yeah.
What were you doing?
I mean, I don't think I ever got paid for working there, but I definitely had an informal internship. And I mean, I was always around the artists. I mean, I guess Chris Johansson was my babysitter when we did the Liszt affair in Switzerland. I mean, it was just part of my life. It wasn't like I saw my dad on Wednesdays after school and sort of every other weekend. So, I mean, I was always at openings, and it just, I don't know. I didn't realize that was not everyone else's life until I would bring, like, people wouldn't even, my friends didn't really want to come to openings at the gallery because, I mean, especially for my sort of lifetime, the gallery was on Valencia Street, like across from the projects. So it was definitely a sketchy area. I mean, it was like, I mean, now I know it's all very, you know, hipsters on bikes, but it was a lot of sort of strung out drug addicts and a lot of drug dealing, like the, you know, little alley around the corner from the gallery. So I get that maybe it seems like maybe not like a child friendly location, but I definitely spent, God, a lot of time there. And I mean, it was cool because I like, for instance, we work with Alicia McCarthy still, and I've known her forever. Like the whole time she's been at the gallery.
So
It's fun, and she's thrilled I'm at the gallery. She keeps referring to it as the Jack Hanley family band.
Right. So what kind of things...
Which is, again, hilarious because I really cannot play an instrument, but I'll work on it.
What kind of things were you doing when you were just a, you know, teenager at the gallery to help out?
Probably nothing of great use. I think I probably packed a lot of art. I know there were certain pieces that I was always like, oh, I love this. Like, don't sell it. Like, so Elizabeth Payton is just my favorite. And then, of course, my dad would inevitably sell and be like, wow, you were right. I really shouldn't have sold it. But trying to think what I did. I think I helped my dad make some of the buttons and posters, but I don't know. I mean, I was like, you know, kind of a young teenager.
Yeah.
At the time.
Yeah. Because I think the question that, you know, one of the main questions that I wanted to ask you, knowing what you do, and you know the fact that your dad is your boss essentially, and is at what point, you know, if at all, he was training you in a way, or if it was much, if you were to sort of make a kind of snap judgment about the whole thing, that you would just say it was more of an osmosis type of situation, you know, over the years, and that your more formal training came in undergrad and then doing those, that internship and whatnot?
Well, I mean, perhaps he was sort of training me. I mean, I think he wanted to always know if it was something, like he's definitely a very generous spirit and very encouraging. So, you know, my brother had a lot of friends that were Jewish growing up, and he didn't have a bar mitzvah. So my dad threw like a rager 13th birthday for my brother at the gallery. And it's like, he always sort of wanted to see like what you're interested in, I fully support. So, I mean, and my mom's and my stepdad's they're all the same way. So it's great. But I think he knew I liked art and I was taking all these art classes and, you know, whatever, AP studio art, but I really loved photography. So he would, you know, he set up a dark room in our basement in Berkeley, and he really, we basically had like a common language that was art. So he could describe a piece that we had both seen, and I would inevitably know the piece he was talking about, or I could describe a piece because I would remember exactly how it looked. And he instantly, however obscure and random my description, totally knew what I was talking about.
Right.
So I guess in that way, art really was what we talked about. And with my brother, you know, they love basketball. So like it was sports or, you know, football. And I think that it became our common language. I mean, as with like, you know, fashion things and so forth, but it made it so that I was always encouraged to be around the gallery and also to see. I interned at Jeffrey Frankel, Frankel Gallery in San Francisco, and like the Met and the Louvre and all of these sort of amazing institutions. But I always thought it would be more from, like, I always wanted to be a curator at a museum growing up. So I didn't really see myself at a gallery. I think I grew up around it so much that the thought, like, I knew the pitfalls of running a gallery intimately.
Right.
And my dad always talked to me about, you know, conversations he had with artists that were hard. And
okay, wait. Let's not gloss over this particular part of the story.
Oh no.
tell me, what's the first story that comes to mind when you think about some of the challenging situations, particularly with some of your dad's artists?
Like how so? Because there, I mean, we talked about a lot of stuff. Probably more than you should have told a 14-year-old girl.
Right. Here's maybe a good way of introduction. Were there any challenging situations that you were somehow involved with, even if it was just, you know, that you noticed how stressed your dad was getting at a particular moment?
Yeah. I mean, I know him obviously very well, and when something's on his mind, he's usually very quiet until he's ready to talk about it, and then he really wants to talk about it. And so, I don't know, he lived in Berkeley and my mom lived in San Francisco, so there's a lot of potential for conversation in the car. And I think, I mean, it's hard to run a gallery, and a lot of the artists, he has a great eye, so a lot of the artists, you know, when they got big, would be like, look, this gallery in New York wants to show my work, you know, what do you think about that? Which one do you think I should go to? And, you know, he would really struggle with like, yes, I think having another gallery that can bring you something different really complements the program in San Francisco. but he would also, coming from an artist's perspective, really want to make sure that it was a good fit, that they were getting sort of a different clientele, that it wasn't just, like, you don't want two people doing the same thing, you just get entangled, but to have a complement that brings new perspectives and what else, you know, new clients and maybe different institutions, that would be a very productive relationship. So, I mean, I remember it was really hard. I mean, there's tons of things I can think about, but for instance, it was hard when he decided to close the gallery in LA and San Francisco. I mean, he's from New York. He wanted to have a gallery, I think, maybe in the back of his mind in New York for a while. And when he opened it in 2008, most of his artists had galleries in New York, so they couldn't really show with him since he didn't have the space in San Francisco anymore. And I think that was quite hard, and that's just a more recent one. But there was a lot of things. I mean, he is an artist, so he got the trouble, but I think a lot of it came from, you know, people like to get paid, or, you know, if you haven't been paid by a client, you can't pay an artist. But to explain that, it just seems like all my work sold, I just got a statement, why haven't I been paid, is a difficult conversation to explain to somebody that's not involved in the, you know, business side, for instance.
Right, right. Yeah. Sure. I think to press you a little bit, though, on the situation or the occasion when an artist says, you know, I'm in conversation with a New York gallery, what do you think about this one? You know, and you sort of explained it as, you know, yeah, this could be a nice pairing, but it, you know, it's tricky and you have to be careful and whatnot. But for me, and I wonder if this was the case in some cases with your dad, and I think this might be a universal thing, that when you're working in a smaller market and your artist is in conversation with maybe a big New York gallery, let's say, I think there's part of you that says, uh-oh, this could be the beginning of the end. You know what I mean? Of course,
yeah.
You can share that artist, but, you know, if this is a gallery that really, you know, has a sort of drives hard, you could see how that feeling might come up.
Oh, totally. I mean, I think that was probably a reason that he wanted to have a space in New York is, you know, it's a bigger, obviously it's the art capital. I mean, there's the most art buying that goes on here. It's just sort of the center of it all. So I think that was one way he thought to alleviate that problem.
Right.
No, I think obviously if a big New York gallery wants to show your artists and you're in, you know, arguably a provincial sort of city that's, you know, under a million people, it's definitely, it shouldn't be viewed as a threat, but I think it's hard not to fast forward like 5 years from now. Why would they want to go through you when they can just work directly with the artist?
Yeah.
I mean, and they wouldn't even necessarily go through you if you're both representing the artist, but
yeah,
I think it just gets hard. I think the advantage on the flip side, playing devil's advocate a bit, but is that if the artist, like my dad initially worked with a lot of sort of European artist, because when he moved to San Francisco, I don't think he, or even when he was in Austin, I don't think he necessarily had that many artists from that area. But then he quickly entrenched himself with the artists that were local, and now is sort of known for doing like a mission school
right
set of artists.
Right.
But I think that then it became a little easier, because if you are where the artist is, you're where their studio is, and that's, you're going to have access that a gallery in New York that has a bunch of other big artists and is across the country doesn't have that access. So it wasn't necessarily, from what at least I remember and can imagine, I don't think it was necessarily a bad thing. It changed the relationship, certainly.
Yeah. You know, you're still quite young, and so it's not like you have a lot of years to, you know, draw comparisons, but I still was thinking it, so I'm going to ask it, and that is San Francisco versus New York. What do you miss it, first of all? And, you know, what's your take on the lifestyle differences?
I miss it because my family's there, but I really only miss it, I think, when I go back and then realize, oh, wow, you don't even have to check the weather. You just go outside and it's a nice day all the time. And it's naturally cleaner and, you know, physically very beautiful. But to me, the San Francisco that I really grew up in isn't how the city looks now. I mean, it doesn't feel very familiar when I go back. It was a lot grimier. I mean, and I was only born in 90, so it's not like I was there.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was there, you know, my childhood was like the dot-com boom. But even that was much more confined.
Right.
I knew I wanted to work in the art world, so for me it wasn't even a question. I mean, I had been dating my boyfriend for a year already, and I decided, like, no, I've always been planning on moving to New York, so I love it here. I mean, I think it's a really great city that has something for everyone, art world-wise. I mean, San Francisco is not an art scene at all. New York is, so.
Yeah, right, right.
I'm biased, but.
Yeah.
I mean, even if you like, I don't know, opera, it's the best in New York. The one sort of regret that I have is that I do like sports. I'm not like a huge sports fanatic, don't get me wrong, but we always had season tickets to all of the, you know, local teams growing up. So Warriors, Niners, Giants. Actually, my cousins have the Giants season tickets. Regardless, it was frustrating that the moment I moved to New York, all of those teams started doing really well. And
right.
It's really hard to watch the Warrior games at 10:30 at night in New York. And I don't have a TV in my apartment, so like streaming on my computer. It's just that part. That's probably the one bit that sort of irks me is, like, why couldn't you guys have been good when I went to every single game?
I'm still trying to figure out if people who are in contemporary art, who are either jocks or, you know, just big sports fans, if that's like a rare and kind of crazy combination.
God,
but I don't
totally
think it is
rare.
That rare. You think it is rare?
Oh, well, I know a bunch of artists that'll watch games, but not even that many.
Yeah.
Like at Christie's, I would be going to a basketball game and I'd be super excited and people would be like completely, I mean,
flummoxed.
I was in the impressionist and modern department, so understandably
right.
They're quite specialized in that
right.
field, but
right.
they were generally not very excited when I was even going to, I don't know, like a new museum opening or something that wasn't at the Met or Neue Gallery or, you know, something not even as far off as, you know, a Nets game, but I'm always constantly surprised by that people are really specialized in New York. And I mean, it makes sense. You should be. It's a really competitive city. There's the best of everything. So naturally, people are drawn to the city to excel in what they came here for. But the sort of well-rounded approach and interested in taking advantage of what the city has to offer is not widespread, I've found.
Right. I guess it seems like that you, since you are so raised with that sports culture, that it's kind of become, I would imagine it's just makes you associate it with family, and you know, it has that kind of vibe to it, you know, so it's kind of a lifelong draw.
Totally. And I mean, I just think it's I think anyone, if you've really grown up with something that's like, you've gone to the, you've watched them lose like time and time again, you still come back. It's so cool to like see them win. And like, suddenly there's like sports fans all over that care about your team. It's just like,
yeah.
What? This is crazy.
Yeah.
But and maybe part of that was exacerbated in that I went to Berkeley with a whole bunch of kids from SoCal who I really could not, I mean, they would talk about the Lakers nonstop and it just, and bash on the Warriors. I would just think like, you guys are in Berkeley. I mean, it's the Golden State Warriors.
Yeah.
The one that's like all of California.
Yeah. Hate Lakers fans. they're the ones most likely to have those freaking flags hanging out of their car windows.
No. So I went back to San Francisco for the SF MoMA opening.
Uh-huh.
And I guess it was 2 or 3 weeks ago now. And I couldn't believe it. All of these Warrior like flags out the window. It just blew my mind.
Were you proud of that or did you cringe a little bit?
Yeah. Like, you're driving like a Porsche with, like, do you even know where the Oakland Coliseum is?
Right. That's hilarious. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what your level of cognizance was in 2001, 2002, 2003, since you're so young. But, you know, this was the era when it was pretty common for people to have American flag, you know, things hanging out of their car windows the same way. And that was that was even more cringeworthy.
I remember that, especially because my mom has a house up in Sonoma, about an hour north of San Francisco. And
right.
There are definitely, I mean, there's a lot of like, well, at least when I was growing up, there was a lot more farms and cows. Now there's just basically only vineyards. But there's a lot of people with the American flags.
Huh.
Or at least there used to be. Now I feel like it is mainly vineyards, but
right.
There's definitely a different take on what patriotism looks like.
Yeah, yeah. So getting back to the gallery and you and what you do, one can see from your gallery's website the director and then you and your dad, obviously. How small a staff are you? Or do you, I assume there's a preparator. Are there other regular people, or is it pretty much just the three of you for the most part?
Pretty much just the three of us.
Mm-hmm.
Done a pretty good job of getting us a whole bunch of interns, probably more than we would ever need. We have like seven.
Mm. Wow. At a time?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think now it's about like six.
That's pretty impressive.
But there's like a constant. Yeah, I know. I think maybe I was a bit overeager when I started. But there's always like an ebb and flow. Someone can't come in.
Right.
Plus it's nice when we're doing fairs, since we are such a small team, that there can be sort of extra coverage at the gallery.
Right. Okay, so let's get into the remedial description of your job, for lack of a better way of getting into that. Obviously, you've been, you know, as you just mentioned, you were at fairs. So are you... You're one of the salespeople, right, on the floor, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually the part that I think my bosses at Christie's, but also I liked, well, my bosses said about me, but I also liked best, is that I genuinely do like meeting people and talking to people.
Right.
And the really nice part about working at the gallery is I know all the artists super well, and some of them I grew up with, and I'm a really big fan of their art, so it's very easy for me to speak, I would hope, quite eloquently, even to strangers. And I mean, having worked in New York in the art world, and even just sort of grown up with, you know, parents that collect and grandparents that collect, a lot of the people that are at fairs, I mean, they're all very familiar to me. And if they're not, I'm sure through a level of like one degree of separation, I know them. So yeah, I actually really, I mean, I personally hate art fairs. It's just not in my nature
me
to
too.
Like fluorescent lights and low ceilings.
Yeah.
But I think also because I spent a lot of time when I was a kid at art fairs, it's just like, they just feel like a trade fair. I can't get my head around, especially doing them in New York when we have a space that we're paying rent. Like, that just seems illogical to me. But I do get that if you're visiting, it's really great to be able to go for a day, see a whole bunch of international galleries, and you know, it makes it very accessible. So I understand from a buying perspective that they're great. But yeah, I mean, I like meeting people and talking to people. So that's definitely one of the highlights of my job.
So from a business, let's look at it from a business perspective, without, if possible, weighing in your dad's take on it. Are doing fairs and how many fairs necessary for your business? Because either in a less tangible sort of social element, you know, of the networking that you're doing in those fairs, or is it more of a numbers game that you need to make a certain number of sales at a certain number of fairs to have the books line up properly?
I think there's definitely, I mean, I'm a fan of art fairs for the sake of that they are so great for people that are interested in buying art to come and see the gallery. And maybe they wouldn't even know the gallery if they hadn't bought from the gallery before. So I think the exposure that you get is really hard to quantify monetarily.
Right.
You know, marketing is a really hazy budget anyway. And I think as long as sort of the overhead costs aren't so high, I mean, that's why the gallery stopped doing frees, is that the booths were just so expensive that if you're showing young artists, it's just not, it's not practical.
Right.
But for instance, like Miami is like a really successful fair, I think kind of across the board. And I think just as long as you have people that are coming to fairs that are really actually there to see work and buy work, then it's totally worth it. I don't think being driven, you know, transaction by transaction is at all healthy. I think just having a good sense going into it, like our booth was roughly this much, cost of flights and hotels and all that is this much. You know, next year, is it going to be worth it to do this fair again? And obviously it's helpful if you can look over a certain period of time and see like, okay, maybe, you know, the recession was this year, so the market's kind of getting back up. Or, you know, if you take everything into consideration and you're not doing fairs that are really expensive, I think they're a really good thing. I think it's great because I do think, you know, especially my father's gallery is like a small gallery in the Lower East Side. I mean, he's been around for a while, so if you do know about him, it's like you're probably going to go into the gallery regardless. But if you're from, I don't know, I have like friends in Greece and they wouldn't have known about it if I hadn't said like, I'm working here now, you should come by.
Mm-hmm. When you say small, how small is the gallery or how big is the gallery?
Well, I mean, staff wise, there's really sort of just my father.
No,
Randy,
you said, I'm
me.
Sorry. No, I'm sorry to interrupt. You said it's a small gallery in the Lower East Side. So I took it from that. You're talking about square footage. So how, what's the square footage?
Oh, no, I think it's, no, it's not small sort of square footage wise.
Oh, you mean staff wise.
Yeah. I just mean that, you know, there are not that many of us at the gallery physically.
I see. Right.
So
right.
We can't be like everywhere at once, for
right.
instance. Like Werner has a much larger staff, so they can do a lot more art fairs, for instance. So we are a bit choosier with which ones we decide to do. But yeah, I think at least for as long as I've been at the gallery, they've been definitely worthwhile. And I think we've sort of figured out which ones are better for
did
us.
You said used Werner as a comparison, right? As in Michael Werner Gallery?
Oh, David Werner?
Werner. I thought you said Werner with a W.
Oh, sorry. No,
yeah.
My Z wasn't enunciated.
That's okay. I just wanted to check to see which comparison you were making, and I think you were comparing to like the second biggest gallery in the world. So, yeah, most galleries are going to seem pretty small by
biggest,
comparison.
But yeah. No, and the main reason is just there are women that are at Werner, like Bellatrix, Bella, for instance, is, you know, a partner, I think, at Werner, and she used to work for my dad. So I don't know. I guess I don't know why that's like a reference. I have a lot of friends that work.
Well, no, that makes sense. If you're a woman who used to work for your dad as a partner there, what's her name? Bella what?
Hubert. I guess actually, I don't know if she goes by her maiden name still, but yeah.
Got it. Well, that's moving on up, huh?
Yeah, I think she's done really well. There's a
right.
couple other people that used to work for him that are like in his London gallery. I don't know.
Wow.
It's a small art world.
It can be, can't it? When you're going to fairs, right? I mean, isn't that one of the things about fairs is that it's a chance to, I mean, this is something that Deb Cloudman, my frequent co-host, talks about, who's a gallerist, that it's a time to bond with your fellow gallerists.
Yeah. I mean,
you sound a little hesitant about that.
Yeah, I don't think that you're not bonding with them. I think that you definitely see people. I feel like it's not always the best time to catch up because there's like so much going on and you're kind of running between different things.
Right.
And you're sometimes with clients.
Right, right.
And I, from what I hear from my dad doing the fairs a while, they seemed like they were more relaxed in the past and you were just kind of hanging out. I mean, there are fewer galleries back then too, so there's probably a lot of reasons, but every fair I've been at, you definitely are like going out of it at night, but I don't know. It's not quite as much of like a party scene as I maybe expected. I don't know if I was looking forward to it or not. It's disappointed.
I think what you're describing is a sign of success, because the more time you're spending with clients and going to events and the less time that you're spending hanging out with your colleagues from other galleries, you know, kind of the busier you are and in advancing your business, it seems.
Yeah, and I also have a bad habit of probably overextending myself, so maybe that's a bit to blame, but...
right.
Yeah.
Because you just get so wrapped up in your relationships and whatnot that it's like they go on much longer than maybe you had planned, that kind of thing?
Yeah, plus like my grandmother's very involved in the art world as well, and we're very close, so I'll find myself like juggling going to, you know, something she's invited me to versus my mom, and you know, maybe my aunts are in town and my dad got something. So there's a lot of people either peripherally or directly involved in the art world in my life. So there's always something I could be doing.
Right.
So it's usually a juggling game.
Wow. What kind of things is your grandmother, you know, inviting you to? Is she's a pretty big collector, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, I think she's got a wonderful collection, and she's really involved in Dia. So, I don't know, we went for this spring benefit, but for instance, that fell on a day when we had the NADA Art Fair, so it was tricky kind of going to both, and I don't know, I've definitely found that there's always something going on in New York. It's more the game of like, okay, what am I actually going to really focus on?
Did you have the gallery have a booth at NADA, or are you just visiting?
Oh yeah, we had a booth at NADA.
Okay, so you...
My dad's on the board of the fair.
So just to, so this was back in March.
Oh no, just at the beginning of May.
Okay, like, so that would... I'm just trying to get my fair season straight at the same time.
Oh, yeah,
at the same time as Freeze.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, so the
thing
that I was trying to clarify is that you did NADA, but not Freeze, and one of the reasons, the main reason being that Freeze was way too expensive.
Yeah, it was expensive, and I mean, we'd sell a ton of things, and still, it didn't seem cost effective enough, I think.
Right.
But I don't think, you know, I don't think we've ruled out, you know, taking on more fairs, doing fewer fairs. I think there's always sort of a nice ebb and flow, which I really appreciate about the gallery. Since I, you know, worked at Christie's, which is quite a monolith at times, that this sort of dexterity that comes with being in a smaller business means that, you know, you can always reimagine what you're going to do.
Yeah. If I were to ask you what some of your challenges are, I mean, you're great as a people person, you know, which is ideal for somebody working as a director in a gallery, especially a small gallery where, you know, you have less people to cover more ground. But what have been your challenges, either things that are just a bit particular events that have been really hard for you, either in or out of the art world, or, you know, specifically, sort of things that knocked you back that you didn't see coming? Is that specific
enough? Well, I guess there's always... no, certainly. There's always sort of the personal answers. I think it's a little tricky sometimes. You know, my parents are divorced, working at my dad's gallery, you know, and being so close to my mom's family. But also just the day-to-day. I mean, it's different. Working at Christie's was... I sort of really knew the system and I knew very specifically which things I liked and which I didn't. And, you know, the galleries, it's all a little more intertwined. I mean, it's different having my boss be my father, for sure. I mean, the aspects that I envisioned that would be tough because of that have not been, so that's really great. But there's other things. I mean, I'm usually quite a, I don't know, I'm not a very emotional person at times. So, I mean, an artist are emotional. My father is an emotional person. So it's like, it's hard. There are certain things that are new challenges I didn't really foresee. I've been there about a year now, so I definitely feel comfortable with all the artists, which is great. I really enjoy all of them. You know, each are totally different, so there's no like easy way of saying like one challenge. But
right.
I think I was really surprised by what has been difficult. And I'm sorry, that sounds incredibly vague, but to pinpoint it a bit more, I thought, you know, galleries. Like Sarah Friedlander, who used to be in the contemporary department at Christie's, went to work for Paula Cooper for like a very hot second, maybe 3 months or something very short, and then went back to Christie's. And I talked to her while she was at Paula Cooper, and she was like, you know, it's just really quiet being at a gallery. There's like a lot of downtime, particularly in between shows, or, you know, when a show comes up, there's the buzz of getting it up, and then there's the buzz of when it, you know, comes down, but in between there's this sort of lull.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagined, oh my God, it's just going to be like when I worked at the Louvre, and it's like downtime that's, you know, what am I going to do with myself? And luckily I love reading. So I was like, it's cool. I'll just bring a book into the gallery if it's really quiet. And it's been the complete opposite. I mean, perhaps we're understaffed, but it's also just that there is like always something that I could be doing.
Right.
So
what are, can you just give me a, I'm sorry to interrupt, can you just give me or
no,
us a quick laundry list of, other than liaison for the artists and communication with the artists, what are like the top 10 things that you find yourself doing off the top of your head?
Oh my gosh. I mean, just beyond like daily operations of a gallery, there's also like, I mean, our artists are doing like a million different shows. I mean, there's like, you know, museum shows, institutions, other galleries. So there's like constant stream of consignment paperwork or loan agreements,
right?
Invoices, bookkeeping. I mean, just the gamut. So, I mean, I like to always make sure I'm quite diligent of responding to people, but yeah, there's definitely more, kind of busy work than I expected. Even just, you know, photographing the show, sometimes a lot of professional photographer, but
right.
I really like photography, so I'm usually very happy to do it. But like editing images, I mean, just silly things,
sure, sure.
That like maybe I don't have to do, but I happily take on, and it definitely fills up the day.
Yeah. No, that's good. I wanted to give not just me, but people listening a sense of, you know, what somebody in your size gallery.
Sort of,
yeah.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, I was used to sort of a strict, not even a strict schedule, but like a very cyclical and professional workplace, which was Christie's. And it's definitely, you know, more laid back, but it's also like, I mean, I'm emailed by clients and artists, and I mean, it's just like 24/7 and texted, and it's just not as sort of a work-life balance. It's not as, like, I'm not, work like at Christie's, I would work for, I don't know, 9 a.m. till 2 a.m. sometimes. And it's not, I'm not at the gallery till 2 a.m. ever, thankfully. But I still will get, you know, a 8 a.m. text and be like, oh my God, this, what? The gallery's not open till 11. What's
right.
happening?
Right. What are your boundaries now, would you say? Are you able to keep any, as far as like, I will not take a text or a call after or before a certain point?
I feel like this is dangerous in case any artists are listening, but...
Don't worry, they aren't.
I definitely answer phone calls, because I feel like in this day and age, while I call my best friends and prefer phone calls to texts, I feel like that's usually a more pressing thing. A text message I'll definitely always look at, but sometimes I'll wait to respond. I always get nervous to wait because they like fall to the bottom.
Right.
But emails, you know, that like flagging feature is my new best friend.
Sure.
So I like to be aware of what's going on, but I've tried really just checking my email, like either in the morning or at night on my weekends. Especially cause my weekends are Monday and Tuesday. So it is a tricky system, because if you're doing shipping, like they're going to respond to you not on the Saturday that I email, but on the Monday when they're in the office.
Mm-hmm. Is it, so your weekend is Monday and Tuesday, but the gallery isn't actually open on Sunday. It's just that you're working on Sunday?
No, no. So the Lower East Side is, I don't know, probably one of the last places, but it's open Wednesday through Sunday.
Ah.
The galleries predominantly are open Wednesday through Sunday.
Oh, got it. How long has this been going on, do you know?
For as long as we've been there.
Okay.
There was some talk of shifting to mirror Chelsea's hours, but understandably, I mean, it's nice to stagger a day so that collectors or even just people that are excited to see a show can come in on a day that they don't have to. Like if we were only open, for instance, Tuesday through Saturday, much as Chelsea is, it would mean that people on their Saturday would either have to like jump across town or decide between the two. And with only, you know, shows being open 4 to 5 weeks, it's just not really enough time.
I wish there was a Sunday policy here, actually. It really would. It would be great. And
totally,
China,
the galleries might not agree.
Well, Chinatown back in, I think, like 2008 or somewhere around there, 9 maybe, tried doing a Sunday thing, and it lasted for about 2 or 3 weeks, I think. And some of them weren't even open.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think Soho used to do it to compete with sort of the Midtown gallery. So it is sort of like a young gallery thing to do in New York,
right?
To set yourself apart. This sort of yearly debate of if we're shifting is still continuing.
Yeah.
And I think I see both sides. I mean, I get that it's cool to be open a day when, you know, Chelsea is closed so that there's a draw to come see art in the Lower East Side. But it definitely makes it a little tricky when you're trying to respond to people because you really only have a couple of days of overlap.
Yeah.
Especially if you then add in, like, you know, what if you're doing a project in China? You literally have, like, maybe 48 hours if you're lucky.
Is that a situation you've been in?
Well, Margaret Lee is doing a big couple projects over there. So yeah. But even if it's not China, I mean, it could be, like, France, and there's still enough of a time difference that when I get into the gallery, I mean, the gallery's open at 11, so you don't have much time.
Right. When you were talking just a little while back about your various activities and you were, I can't remember the exact context, but you were certainly comparing yourself to some of the artists and your dad, and you said that you weren't an emotional person, and I take that, and I think listeners probably take that to mean that you are sort of maybe not acting out or not getting overly passionate or what have you. But why don't you not let me put words in your mouth and tell me what you meant by that?
Well, I've jokingly been told it by people. But I think it just means, I mean, I'm a middle child. I don't know what that all means, except
Marcia?
That, like, I'm sorry.
I just said Marcia. I don't know if you happen to know that reference by any chance.
Yeah.
Okay, good for you.
No.
Kid born in 1990 gets a Brady Bunch reference. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. No, I get a lot of them. I loved, well, obviously not the same generation, but I loved Hitchcock growing up. So you can make as many sort of antiquated references.
Good.
As long as it's not TV-based and movie-based, hopefully I'll get it.
Okay.
I think I basically, and my parents are really different. So like I'm used to sort of having to approach something and not play mediator, but sort of understand the different sides, which I hope you haven't already noticed from the interview, but unfortunately I seem to be quite good at seeing how people will react to things. And maybe that's why I enjoy meeting new people, is sort of the challenge of like, oh, like, how do you react to these situations, or what are you excited about? And I think it's often a strength, but it also means that I am quite good at separating myself from the issue and not like taking it too much to heart.
Right.
And so I often, you know, when artists are really emotional, and as they should be, I mean, they're around their ideas and their feelings, and I think if you're going to turn something into something else, it takes an obsessive quality that maybe people who aren't artists don't relate to. I think having parents who are artists, and especially growing up, you know, divorce. I mean, you can break down in a million different ways, but I do really feel comfortable with, I don't know, the gamut. So I think in a way that makes it quite easy to deal with different personalities, but mm-hmm. it also means that there are times when I'm like, okay, I know you're not trying, you're avoiding the main issue here. You're nervous about your solo show, or you're nervous about your museum show, and you're just talking about X to avoid, you know, your show. And that's sometimes hard and feels like a therapist, as you're like, no, but really, what do you think the problem is? Or like, what do you want to work on?
Right. I think, you know what, you're making me think back to when I was trying to get you to dig some dirt about, you know, your dad and some of the situations with his artists earlier on. And I think maybe a much better way to ask it is if, you know, because you were, the image you were starting to form for me was, you know, your very diplomatic and measured dynamic relationships with in handling the artist, and I think that's a fair word to use, is whether there have been occasions where, you know, an artist really does kind of get a little out of control and you kind of have to go through. I mean, this is, I recognize a bit of an antiquated idea, you know, but I know it still happens, you know, that you have artists who can be difficult. And I guess I wonder if any occasions come to mind, and, you know, and you certainly don't have to mention any names, but.
Yeah. I mean, there are definitely times when I think the sort of stress of what's going on gets to people, and I think that's in every aspect of life. And I think it takes, I mean, that's why I think it helps that I'm good at taking myself out of the equation, is that, like, I can understand when someone's freaking out about something and saying all these things that aren't really true. I can understand that they're not true and they're not meant to be hurtful. They're just really concerned about something, that it's easier to get mad at someone that's an ally rather than sort of address their fears head on. And thankfully I really haven't had too many of these, but, you know, my colleague and my dad, so I've been around them either firsthand or secondhand a fair amount. And, I think you have to be patient in a way that I wasn't expecting.
Right. It just seems really counterintuitive to, I think, to me, and I would hope a lot of people, that, you know, this gallery is doing everything for you that they can, you know, to advance your career, and that you would turn around and in an extreme situation yell at the people that are doing these things for you. That just, I mean, I, as an artist,
oh my God, do you want to come work at the gallery?
I would be happy to start on a consulting basis ASAP.
No, I mean, that's the thing. If you break it down to its core, it doesn't make sense. But it's the same reason, if you think of it, like, not to compare a gallery to parents, but, like, it's easier to yell at your parents, or it's easier to yell at your friends,
sure,
your boyfriend, your husband,
right,
what have you.
Right.
Because you know that at the end of the day, they are there for you and they have your back.
Right.
And I think it's just avoiding your fears is quite common in life, and it's harder to address them head on. I mean, if we were all that evolved, therapists and any related industry would be out of business. So there's clearly a reason that people, it's scary to say, no, I'm freaking out about this show and I don't know what to do. I'm really nervous about the series I'm doing. You know, this idea I'm trying out keeps breaking, whatever it is. It's scary to say that, because then it's like, yeah, but you're the only one that can fix it. Because I think artists know that. Like, it's your problem. It's your life. It's your career. You have to be the one that does it. But it's easier to be like, no, you didn't, you know, you encouraged me to show this piece. I wasn't ready. You did this. So I think in a lot of ways, for everybody, it's a really good lesson, even if you still freak out at the people you care about, to at least be able to say, wow, I'm really sorry. I did not mean to get mad at you. And I mean, that's really rare. I rarely have come across people that later, I mean, I don't even personally care if they apologize or not, but at least notice that they're planting their fears in sort of the wrong, and that it's coming out as anger and it's misplaced.
Yeah. See, now if Jerry had actually been able to identify these things, these really invaluable tools that you have, if he had said, you are such the classic middle child with all of the well-adjusted tools of being able to handle artists, you should totally work for your dad. Then would be able to give Jerry some credit. But for him to actually...
No, I give him credit. I give him full credit. He's telepathic. And just knows.
Right. Okay.
No, I mean, I think a lot of it comes, like, my mom's family is, you know, kind of, not social isn't the right word, but like, they've all lived in San Francisco forever. So I think I'm comfortable both with artists and with people that collect. And I think that's a rarity. And I think that was, I don't know if Jerry picked up on that, but my dad certainly pointed that out to me.
Yeah.
And I, from what everything I've heard about my great grandmother, since we didn't overlap for very long, she was really great. You know, she'd have a phenomenal dinner party, and it would be like, you know, the prince of some country next to the janitor, and it didn't matter. She just found the interesting aspect in each person, mm-hmm. and I would flatter myself maybe I have that quality, but even if I don't, I think at least I am comfortable with a lot of different types of people, which maybe is not
right.
as common in our world.
I this is going to be a really kind of out of left field question, but you haven't done any therapy, I take it, in your life, have you?
Oh, no, I have. But, oh, and this is also pretty messed up, but I used to play, when my parents got divorced, we all went into therapy, which was great because it, like, gave you a venue you could talk about things. I just didn't really want to talk about things, so I didn't, or maybe I did, but I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely remember I always wanted to play old maid, and I would make my therapist sit in front of the window because it was inevitably a sunny day, and the light would shine through her cards, and I could, like, totally see what she had in her hand. So either I'm really twisted, or very pragmatic.
Right.
Or really competitive. I don't know. But it did. I mean, I did like that my parents always encouraged therapy. And I think in a lot of ways, it's nice to know that, like, if I ever wanted to go into therapy, I could easily, you know, have the support of my family thinking it was a great idea. I think having somebody that'll listen to you and help you sort out your ideas so you have the tools to do in the future is, like, a wonderful gift.
Yeah. The reason I think, part of the reason I ask is because you were creating this image of you, or describing this personality in yourself that knows how to handle a lot of different complicated situations, especially for somebody so young. So I was wondering, you know, if that therapy had some play in that situation, or if it was, you know, that wasn't really... You were aware of it, but really you sort of had those tools just because of the way that you were raised.
Hard to say. I mean, I don't know if it was my therapy. I mean, my parents are big proponents of therapy, and I think it gave them really great tools to be able to deal with relationships moving forward, you know, professional and, you know, romantic, business, you name it. And so I think in some ways, maybe that sort of funneled down. I always think communication is, like, a really wonderful, essential part of any relationship. But I also think it might have just been having a lot of random, strong personality types in my family. Like, if you put everybody in a room, I mean, just the gamut that runs is, I don't know anybody else. I mean, every family is different, so there's that. But there's a lot of sort of strong opinions in my family.
I think it's important that, though, that, and I'm going to assume that the strong personalities were also generally healthy personalities, because if you have a combination of a strong personality and narcissistic, that can be a little bit more complicated, to say the least.
I'm sure some people in my family would fight you on that, but for my relationship with them, I think that everyone is very healthy. I think they've got their flaws, for sure.
Right.
I really do adore everyone in my family, so I'm very lucky.
Right. I did want to ask you about the West Village before we stop, since that's where we started. Just because I myself lived in Manhattan for a number of years, and I knew the West Village to be probably the most beautiful neighborhood in Manhattan, and if not New York City. And I just wonder, you know, now that Manhattan is turned into this island of rich people, you know, to what extent, you know, what is the demographic that you see in your neighborhood?
Well, I've moved around every year. So I lived in Soho, I lived in different parts of Brooklyn, and moved back because I worked so much at Christie's and wanted to be basically off the express train, but not living in Midtown.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of the thought process. Granted, I could have lived in a couple of different areas and been there in just as quick a time, but I always thought of the West Village as really beautiful. I like all of the sort of low buildings and neighborhoody aspect, which is a little bit outdated because a lot of it is just rich people. My apartment building, for whatever reason, seems to be quite neighborhoody. There's a lot of people that have lived here forever. And obviously parts of it are rent controlled. I don't really think mine is. My room's also tiny, so
right.
It has its disadvantages. But I am really good friends with a lot of my neighbors, and for some reason it's really European. But I think I started realizing that, like, all of Manhattan is super rich. Like, there's no bad part of Manhattan.
Right.
And I hadn't really ever experienced that until I went back to San Francisco and realized, whoa, the parts that were shady when I was little, like, really aren't shady. And it's not like, oh, I've just gotten older and I feel more comfortable, because I never felt uncomfortable in them. But even my dad, that, like, really would not be fazed by a lot of things, hated where I did ballet, because he was like, I don't want you waiting outside the building. And I never would think twice, but it's like, I mean, Mid Market used to be rough in San Francisco, and not rough in like, oh my God, I'm going to get jumped or something. But like, it was a lot of like, I don't know, a lot of drug addicts, people sleeping on the streets. I mean,
sure.
It's not where you'd leave your 10-year-old daughter.
Right.
And I never felt that way in Manhattan. So the fact that all of it's so expensive, it was sort of like, what the hell? I'm living in New York. It's going to be expensive. Unfortunately, that was just sort of a realistic thing. But it is nice. As you mentioned, I do live with my boyfriend, so the rent is less than it would be if I was by myself.
Right.
That's not why I'm dating him.
can you walk to the gallery, or is that a little too far?
No, I walk. Almost every morning.
That's awesome.
Which I love.
Yeah.
That was a total perk.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. That's sweet.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And it means that I can, like, run on the West Side Highway and, like, bike around on those city bikes. Although I'm, like, a terrible biker, so it's dangerous. But
how are you a terrible biker?
Well, I, like, managed to, like, cause multiple accidents just today. The one time I rode, like, I don't know, up to... Yeah, it's just, I don't know. I'm really bad on the bike. I think I either go too slowly and, like, cause accidents behind me, or I'm not aware of my surroundings.
Emma, I think we finally found a weakness.
Yeah, oh, no, definitely my weakness.
You know, it's been lovely talking to you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, you're very welcome. I hope I didn't get too off topic.
No.
Anything if any, you would want us to ask.
If anything went off topic, it was all my directing. So thank you so much, Emma. It was such a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
You're so welcome. Have a good evening.
Thank you. You too.
so young and yet so wise. Thank you so much again to Emma for talking to us. Really appreciate it, Emma. And want to remind you guys that this is a listener-supported show. I want to thank the several of you who have re-donated recently, which means there are still tons of you out there who have yet to donate. I wanted to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. There's a lot of time and energy that goes into this show, including the assistance of an intern as well. So we need to raise money not only for the switch over to Libsyn, which we're almost there for, but for the ongoing continued cost for the show. So you need to go over to theconversationpod.com/support, make an easy donation there. And if you set me up as family, we can get rid of that 3% fee that PayPal charges. In any case, your donation is very much appreciated. And donators to the show have access to the bonus episodes, including the Max Maslansky bonus episode, which has already been sent out and can be sent out again when you join. And we will have an upcoming one with Amanda Yates Garcia on what it means to be a witch, the cliches, whether they're true or myths. So you will get that as well. But otherwise, your donation is very much appreciated. Anywhere in the neighborhood of $20 to $2,000 is very much appreciated. You can also, of course, support this show by spreading the word. Word of mouth is always great and much appreciated. And you can leave a nice review on iTunes, which will help more people find this show. In fact, if you go to iTunes, leave a nice review, and subscribe to the show, and then you can even unsubscribe if you really don't want it on your feed for whatever reason. That actually apparently helps with numbers, just getting that initial subscription. You can also, of course, subscribe to the show on Stitcher and other platforms that are out there. You can follow the podcast on Instagram and Twitter at Artist Podcast. You can become a fan on Facebook. We are getting fairly close to 1,000, so when we hit that 1,000 mark, you will definitely win the raffle. I'm not sure what that prize is yet, but I definitely want to give you something special. So if you haven't liked the show yet, go over there and maybe we'll be the 1,000. All right. Do contact me if you have any suggestions for art-adjacent experts in the economy, style, business, art-type arena. I would very much appreciate it. All right, that's it for now. I will talk to you next week. Thank you very much for listening. I will talk to you then. Ciao for now.